I'm Greg Johnson.
And I'm John Morgan.
I'm Michael Polignano.
Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. Our guest today is James Alsup. James came to my attention first, I believe, after the Shelbyville rally this past year, when there was a debate that was opened up about optics and about American nationalism. And I thought that the position he took on it, which strangely was also the position of Andrew Anglin. Suddenly Andrew was one of the most sagacious and moderate people out there on the scene about how we should really stick with American symbolism. I thought that was very valid. I thought that was a powerful argument. And so I started following James around that point. James is a 22-year-old commentator and activist. He has a YouTube presence and a Twitter presence. He does very, very well done YouTube videos. So I just wanted to have this session to get better acquainted. So James, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
I first met you a couple weeks ago when you were in Seattle for a rally, basically, and there were some 200 or so screaming, scruffy Antifa types and about 50 nationalist types there. And we had a brief conversation afterwards, and I thought we should just do a podcast so the world could listen in as I find out more about you too. So my first question really is how did you get to be a thought criminal at the tender age of 22?
Well, it happened naturally, and it happened in a very, I guess you could say it happened publicly and organically, because I was involved with conservative politics beginning back in 2015 when I worked as a student leader, as a state leader for the Rand Paul campaign. I was a sophomore in college, or a junior in college at that point. I was a sophomore in college, and I needed an internship because I was a political science student, and I knew that I would not be able to go anywhere career-wise if I did not have internships and experience in college. So I began by working for the Rand Paul campaign in 2015. And through the 2016 presidential election cycle, I really came across a lot of new information and theories that really opened my eyes and exposed me to what was going on in the world. And through watching the Syrian migrant crisis unfold in Europe, through listening, beginning to listen to people like Jared Taylor, beginning to listen to other intellectuals on what I guess could be termed as race realist intellectuals, you could say, I realized that there was a reason these philosophies that I was following didn't make sense. It didn't answer all the questions. There's a reason that right-wing libertarianism wasn't answering all of my questions about society, or that neoconservatism was an incomplete philosophy. So once I realized that there was a truth being hidden from people like me and from the masses, and I kind of broke free and was able to start doing my own research, I realized that our country was not what the left was saying it was, and it was not what the right was saying it was. We were not supposed to be a diverse, beautiful rainbow melting pot landscape. And we were not supposed to be just an economic zone for global trade either. There was something more to America that had been lost. And then once you start doing the research into 1965 and 1924 and these immigration acts, you realize what's happened to our country. So I was working as the senior advisor and the national field director for the Students for Trump organization in 2016. I was very involved in youth politics, youth right-wing politics. I actually had a spot on the advisory board, national advisory board for the College Republican National Committee. And I was publicly talking about the wrong things, and those positions were revoked. I identified as someone who attacked me and hospitalized me in Washington DC during the inauguration. I identified him as Jewish based on his phenotype. And I was removed from my position for identifying a Jewish individual. And so I started to really look into why these things are and why certain topics are taboo. And I was just doing it very honestly and publicly at the time. I didn't have a strong YouTube presence back in, I guess what would be January of 2017. I was just kind of a guy making videos on my college campus. But because I was telling the truth about these things and because I was being very honest and direct about what's going on in America, I've been able to find success in political commentary. So I appreciate that. And I've been unafraid to just address these issues openly and honestly ever since that.
That is great. How do you describe yourself ideologically? That's sort of a loaded question, a loaded topic. So where do you fit in the ideological spectrum then?
Well, I identify as an American nationalist and I identify as an identitarian. And I identify as an American nationalist because I am not one of these people. There are quite a few people on the alternative right, and I understand their position, but they believe that we need to move past America. We need to, and in fact, beyond, not just moving past America, there are some people who believe that we need to be anti-American in a sense, because America has enabled, global diversity, and America has been the agitator of all of these foreign wars. And I don't believe that. I think that America was founded essentially with the same goals that most of us have in mind. If you look at the 1790 Naturalization Act, and you all know this, of course, but one of the first acts of our first Congress was to establish a citizenship process that restricted citizenship to free white people of good character. And like going back to the founding fathers and the founding of this country, they were aware of the issues that would eventually undermine the American Republic and American democracy, if we want to use that phrase. So I don't think the founders really, I think the founders were on the right track. And I don't think it's productive for us to be anti-American or to denigrate the American identity, because especially if we think about winning politically, there are 63 million Americans out there who voted for Donald Trump, who love America, who are pro-American, and 95% of those people are white. So when we think about appealing and building a mass political movement, being anti-American seems just about the most counterproductive thing that we could be. I think that being pro-American, being an American nationalist, and along with American nationalism comes the implication that we want to return America to the demographics of its founding, to the demographics of the 1700s, 1800s, and early 1900s. And the left, by the way, will react in kind. The left treats American nationalism as if it's the most dangerous, scary, evil Hitlerian ideology out there. So I don't think that American nationalism is really in any way hiding like true beliefs. Like people will accuse those of us who identify as American nationalists as masquerading or as being intellectually dishonest. But I don't think it is at all. I think it's a very clear, easily defined position that has a lot of potential to win over the conservative base that we are going to need. Frankly, we're going to need the white conservatives to build a mass political movement.
I agree with you. My caveat, though, would just be that, you know, obviously, if we want to have a political movement in America that appeals to a broad swath of especially white America, you know, we can't present ourselves as, you know, being opposed to everything that America not only is but ever was. That's true. But at the same time, I don't think we should become apologists for America. I mean, we have to admit that, especially over the last 70 years or so, you know, America has been responsible for quite a bit that's been damaging both internationally and also, of course, within the U.S. itself. So
yes.
I always say that when I refer to the radical right, you know, I always say that I mean radical not in the sense that we're the most extreme, but in being willing to question the foundations on which American society is currently founded. But yeah. It's true that we've come so far that if you go back to the way people thought about America in the early 19th or even the 18th century when it had just been founded, it is revolutionary because they had completely different suppositions about what America was and what it could be. So I think to want to go back to that is actually, well, I mean, we never go back to it, but something, you know, with the same kind of values that they had at that time. That is something revolutionary, which of course is the original meaning of the word revolution. It means, you know, coming back to your origins. So yeah, I think what you're advocating for is absolutely what's needed, and it's revolutionary. I just think we have to be willing to be critical of America at the same time. Like I remember, I'm not saying you would necessarily say this, but when I've been critical of things like the Iraq War, things like that in the past, some people say, well, you know, that's anti-American. How can you not support something that America's engaged in? We have to not allow ourselves to get sucked into that kind of argument. And I think that that's still, even a lot of Trump voters might have difficulty distinguishing between those two things. They might have difficulty understanding how you can love America, be an American nationalist, and yet also, you know, not support a lot of the things that America is currently doing. So I think our task is to show people why these things are bad for America too.
Right.
Yeah, America has been hijacked, and we, as American nationalists, and I'm comfortable calling myself an American nationalist, if we're very, very clear about what we mean by American nationalism, and also very critical of how America has been hijacked, and that many, many things about America today are really quite foreign to the original nation and are based on lies and falsehoods. For instance, I wrote an article called "Is White Nationalism Un-American?" because a lot of people will just say, white nationalism is an un-American idea. America was always a multiracial society dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. And that's all bunk. That is a false image of America that has been fostered. Really, it started in the 19th century with radical Republican types like Daniel Webster, who were trying to read the idea of universal equality from the Declaration of Independence, which is not a legal document of the United States anyway. It's an interesting historical document, but it's not the law of the land. And what they tried to do is read that ideology into the Constitution. And eventually what happened with Lincoln, basically, Lincoln replaced the Constitution and the old Republic with a new system, the Union, which is a Jacobin state dedicated to egalitarianism. And the idea of America as a melting pot, as a universal society open to everybody, all of that is based on that false substitution of this egalitarian rhetoric in the Declaration for the actual founding documents of the country, and it has been exacerbated ever since, basically by the left. This is a left-wing revisionist reading of the meaning and history of America, and we have to combat that. And it's easy to combat because it's just so false. It's false and it's obvious. I just want to mention one book that really helped open my eyes. This was recommended to me by Paul Kersey about 10 years ago now, and it's extremely useful. It's put together by S.T. Joshi, who's a East Indian born scholar. He's primarily known for his work on H.P. Lovecraft, but he edited an anthology called Documents of American Prejudice, an anthology of writings on race from Thomas Jefferson to David Duke. And of course, he's offering this as an indictment of America. And when I read it, I thought, my goodness, Americans have been far more sensible about race than I gave them credit for. And it sort of helped me get rid of these European New Right spectacles and a sort of European anti-Americanism that I had uncritically absorbed, and helped me come to recognize that there's a real tradition of race realism and racial nationalism in America. And the most authentic thing that we can do to save our nation is to try and bring our people back to that, because they already resonate with the symbols of America, and they've just had the switcheroo performed, and so the symbols resonate with meaning, but the substance has been changed into this universal ideology. And if we can change that back, we're already there. Real American nationalism is what we want.
And when you look at the opinions and views of this 63 million person mass, the, again, 95% white that voted for Donald Trump, when you ask them on specific issues, they know the problems being presented by diversity. They know that America is not what it was supposed to be. And the unfortunate thing is that so many of them are elderly. And so they will just say, oh, well, there's nothing we can do about it. Let's kick the can down the road. And these are people who just want to hopefully die before 2045, when America becomes minority white. But for the younger people, for the Gen X individuals in that 63 million person mass, they recognize that things are going off the rails. They recognize that things are going down the wrong path, and they are looking for solutions. They are hungry for honest answers to what is going on, because the sort of conservative ink or broader right-wing understanding or MO for a long time has been to just deny race. And I think back to when I was young, I grew up listening to local talk radio here in Seattle. I would listen to people like Michael Medved, who was, of course, a Jewish host. And he would present the narrative that, no, America's founding fathers actually did not care about race. America's founding fathers were colorblind. They intended for America to be this multiracial country. And then from the left, you hear that, no, Americans founders were always racist. They were always bigots. They wanted to keep minorities in chains or keep them down or whatever. And so neither one of these is actually correct. I think the left is actually, their narrative about race in American history is actually getting more to the truth, but they ascribe a insidious connotation to it that I don't think was there. I think the founding fathers wanted America to be free for Americans, and they recognized the problems that would be posed by diversity. It wasn't a decision made out of hatred or just dislike or some kind of like anti-scholarly racism, backwoods racism or something. It was a decision. These immigration decisions were made out of a recognition that multiracial, multiethnic societies cannot stand and they cannot survive. These founding fathers were all scholars. They know what happened to Rome. They know what happened to every other nation throughout history that had attempted to become multiracial, and they did not want that to happen for their new creation, America, or the United States. Excuse me. And the right, the mainstream right, just presents this narrative about race and history that is historically revisionist. And people know that. I think people instinctively know that it's not true. This whole Democrats are the real racist narrative or the narratives about the founders being anti-racial. So if we can provide them a narrative that makes sense and that is historically based and accurate, then we will have no problem winning them over to our side politically.
I agree. I think that one of the things that's on our side, in addition to the real meaning of America and the existing patriotism of that 60 plus million people who voted for Donald Trump, is also human nature. One of the most white pilling experiences I had was listening to a talk by Kevin MacDonald where he talked about implicit racism. And before I heard that talk, I had heard about implicit racism, and I thought, oh, this is just some sort of occult explanation that's being put forward to explain why now that explicit racism has been basically banished, that minorities, non-white minorities, aren't performing equally to whites. But his argument is that the science is true. There really is implicit racism, that ethnocentrism is wired into our brains and has a very, very long pre-human, pre-mammalian evolutionary history. It goes back hundreds of millions of years, and it's there. And for me, that was a huge, hugely encouraging message, because I sort of had the picture in my mind that we had to completely reprogram people in their thinking about race. Whereas the truth is that they already have racial instincts that they are suppressing, and that the system, the culture, is suppressing with this anti-racist programming. And therefore, our task is really getting past that programming and getting in touch with what people really think. And so it's helping people become more authentic, getting in touch with their real feelings. And so that's on our side. Nature's on our side. We have a fifth column in everybody, including every liberal. And that is their own amygdala, their own pre-human, pre-mammalian brain that is wired for ethnocentrism. And I think that it's helpful to frame what we're doing as a quest for authenticity, a quest for honesty and courage to face up to who we really are. And that is true as organisms, where we have preferences that are based on biology. And also, I think, expanding it more to the cultural realm, I think we should conceive of nationalism as a quest for authenticity as well, against these universalistic, globalizing abstractions, and getting back to the real traditions of our societies. And it turns out that every European society and every European colonial diaspora society has had a robust tradition of race realism. And it's just been covered up by all this revisionism carried out by the left. And if we can get people in touch with their real feelings about ethnicity and their real traditions I think that that is a hugely empowering way of looking at this, rather than simply, you know, the route of people who want to wave foreign flags and things like that. I mean, they're in the position basically to Americans like a conquering army would be. And they're not going to win. We're not going to conquer America with an anti-American ideology that's born out of deep feelings of disconnectedness and rootlessness. The way I put it in this one essay called On the Relevance of the Old Right is that people who are LARPing as Nazis and fascists in America today, that this is not an alternative to rootlessness. This is an expression of it. This is a manifestation of it. And there's a much more authentic, rooted, and non-self-defeating, practical way forward, which is this kind of renovated American nationalism.
I still think that we can draw on these sources, though. Like, I think the European right is definitely something, you know, we have a lot to learn from. So I don't think it's something we should reject. But in terms of the way I see it, there's the intellectual right and there's, you know, quote unquote, the movement, which personally I don't think actually exists yet, even though, you know, we sometimes refer to it that way. But, you know, practical politics and the ideological underpinnings of it are really two separate things, because in the intellectual world, you have to be willing to draw from many different sources. And I think going to continental Europe, you know, we can, well, I know you would agree with this, Greg, because you write about continental ideas all the time, but
right.
You know, we should be drawing on these things, but that's not really something that's for consumption by the masses. I mean, we can use it as a source, but you know, we can't go around saying that, you know, like we want to be like, you know, Cornelio Codrianu, or you know, we want to revive, you know, we want to revive, you know, the conservative revolution in Germany in America today.
Right.
I mean, that we can draw on these things and learn from them. But I don't think that it's actually the case that, you know, we're actually going to be, you know, we're going to have future politicians speaking about, you know, Mother Vandenbroek, you know, or something like that in speeches. I mean, it's two completely different things.
Yeah, we can have this idea. Okay, how do we save America? Okay, first, we convert to Orthodox Christianity.
Right, yes. And some people are saying this.
I know, it doesn't make any sense. First, we become Orthodox Christians. Or first, we become esoteric Hitlerists. Well, if that's the first step, I'm afraid we're not going to get to step two, much less to victory.
Right. I think the reason those European movements that we admire succeeded is because they were authentically German, or they were authentically Italian, or they were authentically wherever else they've succeeded. They had roots and they had a basis in the identity of the people, and they had a basis in the history of the people. And there is an idea in America that we are not a real people, so that therefore we cannot have history or a cultural basis from which to draw on for nationalist identitarian movements. And that just simply isn't true. I think that America is unique, of course, because it was designed to be an amalgam, a country where an amalgam of European peoples could come and build a new society. But that doesn't mean that we don't have roots from which to draw on. There is a distinct American culture. There's a distinct American identity. A white American is a valid identity in the same way that a German, or the same way that a Swede, or the same way that a Norwegian is. And we can't be ashamed of our own identities. We can't be ashamed of our own identities as white Americans. Because if we are, then we will constantly be looking to Europe for a movement to adopt, or a movement to revive in America. But that isn't what's going to connect with people. People in America identify as Americans. People we want to win over, people we will win with, identify as Americans. And instead of running from it, we should embrace that.
I agree. One book that, and it's a massive, massive investment of time, but it flew right by. One book that really helped me get a sense of the distinctness of the American culture is Mencken's The American Language. Because culture is encoded in language when you get right down to it. They're non-linguistic practices, ways of building, ways of doing things, but so much of it is encoded in language. American English is different from English English. And there's so much in American English that, say, derived from German, or other groups that were very, very prominent in the peopling of America. And so we have a distinct cultural identity. We have a distinct American English language. We have distinct American English ways of doing things, or just Americaner ways of doing things in food and building and so on. And a lot of Americans, they're taught to disdain this as, oh, boring and white bread, et cetera, by the left, or people on the right, especially people who are on the European New Right, they think of Americans as just some cultureless amalgam, some cultureless amalgamation of the scrapings of Europe.
Well, kind of is, to be fair to the New Right, it kind of is becoming that way. I don't think America was always that way, but their criticism isn't without foundation. And I can also understand how, from a European perspective, you know, they've had American culture kind of forced down their throats for the last 70 years. So I can understand why they adopt this position, but we can't just import it
right
into the United States.
We don't need to start hating ourselves all over again for different reasons, basically, and for spurious reasons, too. But yeah, I mean, people on the European right that I know look at Americans as just this hideous cultural and racial mongrels that have no distinct culture. And I find that increasingly annoying. And the cure for that is, and I'm not naming any names, I'm not saying this is Alain de Benoist or anybody like that on that level, but I'm saying there are definitely people that I've met over there who have this attitude. I'd like to take them on a tour of New York City, a walking tour of some of the architecture, and then to the Metropolitan Museum of Art's American wing. And yes, you see that we have European roots. We're proud of those roots. But there's something new here, and it's not just a debased, precipitate popular culture. There was a very, very proud and self-confident Euro-American culture that formed on this continent, and it's forming for 400 years now. And it was quite magnificent. So, you know, we don't have to apologize so much for that. We have to stop listening to the haters, though, mostly from the left, but also some from the right. And again, we need to reappropriate what's ours, take back what's ours, our history, our culture, our traditions, our identity as Americans, and then our country. Our country will come naturally at that point. I think the political progress will suddenly become very, very fast and easy once we make these metapolitical changes, I hope.
Yeah, I have hopes for that. I just think that, you know, as we see the alt-right, you know, some people call it white nationalism 2.0. You know, I'm hoping that white nationalism or the alt-right 3.0 won't take so long to coalesce in America, because, you know, time is running out given the rate of change that's taking place. And we really need to come up with something that, you know, isn't so subcultural like the alt-right is, and you know, actually can present a unified front where it's not, you know, a bunch of disparate, you know, small groups all jostling for power and influence. I don't know exactly how that's going to come about. I mean, of course, it'll bear some resemblance to what we already have, but I think it'll be, you know, much broader and much better and much more in tune with ordinary Americans. I'm still thinking about this myself, how that's going to come about, but that's what we need.
So, James, how do you envision this unfolding? You're going to be at this a lot longer than us. I mean, I'm old enough to be your dad, so you're the next generation. You're the future of this. What are your thoughts about how this is going to unfold? And I hope you have a very long career ahead of you piloting this thing towards the goal.
Well, thank you. And I see it envision it happening in a way that, like was just mentioned, is much more friendly and palatable to the masses. I think that if we can make these metapolitical changes and change people's minds like we're doing now and like is currently happening. And I know that there's a constant demand to see results instantaneously. But I think that we can acknowledge that there is a cultural shift taking place, and that the actions of the alt-right, broad alt-right during 2015, 2016, and 2017 have had something to do with that. Now, there have of course been setbacks, and there have of course been disastrous blunders, But there is a growing discussion about race in America. Now, that is a good thing, because as long as I've been an adult, or as long as I can remember in my life, going back to when I was a kid, there was no discussion of race in America. And if there was a discussion of race, it was only about how do we move past it and how do we stop talking about race. But now the left and many on the right are incessant about talking about race. And that may seem like a overwhelming push and an overwhelming tsunami of propaganda that we can't overcome. But I don't think it is. I think that if the left is going to open the door and say it's time to talk about race, that is the best opportunity we could ask for, because that allows us the opportunity to now counteract the narratives being presented by the left and presented by the cucked right, we could call them, and provide the truth and inform people about the truth. So the metapolitical struggle is one that we need to be consistently paying attention to, and we need to win. And I think we can win that easily. Now, the question is, how does this understanding, how does a white racial consciousness manifest itself politically? And that is something that people, I think, have a resistance to. There's a strange resistance that I've noticed among a lot of people in the nationalist or dissident right to politics. They don't want to get involved politically. They don't want to make political change. And our friend Jazz Hands McFeels over at Fash the Nation has talked about this as well, where he has said that is unfortunately just not how it's going to go down. Politics are going to be necessary. We're going to need to gain positions of political influence and power if we want to fight back on what is happening in America and we want to make positive changes going forward. So the question that I have, and the question that I'm concerning myself with most at this point, is how do we get these next generation, the people like me, the people who are in their mid-20s, early-20s, or in their teens, how do we groom the next generation of political leaders? And how do we plug them into the current system that exists? And I think we're doing that already to some limited success. I think I was able to do that myself fairly effectively, but we need to do that times 100, times 1,000, because these political organizations, my experience with them is they are sitting on hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars that they need to spend somewhere. And if they don't have the right people piloting the ship, they will just be spending them on, you know, pro-Israel advocacy or MOLO taxes or other really irrelevant advocacy, or in fact, counterproductive advocacy like that. So if we can get people with our ideological positions and our perspective on race and our perspective on American nationalism into positions where they are making decisions for these political organizations, we will be in a much better shape. We'll be able to hold the elected officials accountable. I'm a young guy. I have hope that there is a political resolution to all of this. I know there will be people who will just say, you know, read Siege and start buying MREs, but I hope that that's not the way forward. I don't think that is the way.
In the 1990s, we thought, you know, when I first got interested in this stuff, we thought that might be the only way, but yeah, not anymore.
Right. And I think the election of Donald Trump has really acted as a massive white pill for a lot of people, because they're realizing that, you know, yes, there are limitations. There are structural things we must overcome politically, but we can still win, right? White America can still win. White America, we're still 65% of this country. We can still save this politically. Mm-hmm. And so getting young people, the people who agree with us ideologically, and we know that Generation Z, I talk to people in Generation Z on a frequent basis, and they are, the Gen Z far right thing is real. Among Gen Z white kids, they are much more far right than my generation ever was, or than past generations ever was. So encouraging these people who are already politically radical in the true sense to fight for their civilization through political means is, I think, the next step. Now, the question is, how do we build that organization? How do we build the network? How do we build the nationalist identitarian version of the Leadership Institute? Or how do we build the identitarian version of the Conservative Political Action Committee? Like, how do we do these things? That's going to be the question going forward that I am going to be trying to answer. And I think that is a worthwhile venture for people to try to answer.
I think that's very important. I think there are really two routes forward. One is to create our own institutions, which requires a lot of money and time and human capital, education and so forth, which we don't have quite yet. The other is to gain some of that experience by getting jobs and working in the existing Beltway and national right-wing political organizations really all over the country. And it's really a sort of a multi-purpose tool to do that. One, you're gaining experience that you can take away and use to start things that are our own. But the other thing that's possible is that you stay in these things, you stay undercover, and you end up hollowing them out and taking them over. And I think that it'll be a little bit of both. There is, I think, a march through the institutions that is now beginning. There are so many younger people who are getting plugged into this. I know people who have been reading Countercurrents since they were 13 years old, and now they're going off to college. It's amazing. And these people are really switched on, and I keep saying to them something like this: I wish I knew the stuff that you knew at 13 when I was your age. I wish that I'd known what you know, James, at the age of 22, when I was at 22 as well. That would have been great. And so one of the things that we're doing with our educational efforts is we're saving people a lot of time. We're helping pass on what we've learned through our own experience to younger people so they can skip over that. And I do think there's a great swell of people who are now moving towards college and jobs. And yeah, we want secret agents to go into institutions and take them over, learn what they can, take them over or take away what they learn and start something new. And I think that both of those things are going to help. To help facilitate that, though, we have to have some kind of network that fosters people, that educates people, that mentors people and steers them in the right direction. And that is something that we need to figure out how to build. We are sort of doing it de facto, but I think there are ways of doing it better. What are some of the lessons you've learned about networking?
When we started this thing, one of the things that we wanted to do was to create an alternative to what we now call conservatism, you know, to create a true right in America. And what you said about, you know, entryism and the Beltway and so forth, Greg, that kind of depends on which way the wind blows, you know, as far as the Republicans go and so forth, because, yeah, there's some hopeful signs there because of Trump, but let's face it, it's still a cucked party. They still hate Trump. And I mean, they're embracing some of these ideas because they understand that they have to survive politically, but we still have to be willing to question these things. And my worry about encouraging people to get involved in the Beltway and so forth is that they would end up being co-opted rather than standing for the principles that we really stand for. You know, I don't think we've seen a real change in the Republican Party yet. I mean, I think James O'Meara said, and I agree, that Trump was basically a third party candidate who hijacked one of the two major parties. So we still have to remember that they don't stand for what we want.
Oh yeah, that's very true, and I do think that they need to be replaced. We need new elites. We need to replace the existing elites in our society, and I think that is beginning to happen. And yeah, the concern is that these things will be co-opted. I just think that the Republicans are too weak and too clueless to really co-opt us. You can't fit a big box inside a small box. We have a much bigger world view, and I just don't think these people are capable of encompassing us and subverting us quite in the way that that it might be possible in other kinds of circumstances. I mean, James, what are your thoughts on this? Is that a danger? Do people, once they get switched on in terms of our ideas, do they ever go back to being conservatives or liberal Democrats?
I haven't seen it. And I think anyone who is strong-willed and serious about these ideas is prevented morally from switching back and prevented morally from changing their positions on this, especially from a full reversal. Now, I will say that there is some risk. For example, hypothetically, somebody gets into the Beltway, they start working for Leadership Institute or CPAC or some other organization, and their views are sort of known, sort of you know, the joke about The Office or something, for example, and they do get, you know, paid off to keep quiet. They get paid off to not go as far right as they would like to. They're still kept around, but they're kind of kept boxed in. Now that's always a concern, but even then they're still gleaning the information from the organization. They're still learning how the organization works, and they're still getting valuable information that can benefit us further going down the road. I think that the risk of co-option for people is significantly less at the local and state Republican Party level, because there simply isn't enough energy or money to afford to co-opt or buy people off. And this is one thing that I found that is very encouraging. And I encourage everybody out there, if you don't believe me, go to your local go to your local county GOP meeting or something. And what you'll find, I virtually guarantee it, is a collection of about 12 to 15 people, maybe 25 if you're in a bigger county, and almost all of them over 55 or 65. Conservatism, cuckservatism, global era, neoconservatism is a dying ideology, literally and figuratively. And these people are dying off in a very literal sense, and they're leaving organizations that are cash flush behind them. And we can be the people to pick up the torch, pick up the tiki torch, I guess, that they're leaving behind, and carry on and take over these organizations and have them passed off to us. I know people, and I've had this experience myself, who, if you show up at a GOP meeting, you be under the age of 40 and you show up at a GOP meeting a couple times, and you are respectful and you're professional, you will be given some leadership role within the third meeting. These people are desperate to get young people involved. And if it just so happens that all the young people getting involved are nationalist right-wingers, they'll have no other choice but to let us get involved. And the ability to be usurped and co-opted is so much less at the state and county and local level that I think there's no risk there. And by the way, these are the people who control, more often than not, who runs in legislative races. You think about why our Congress only has one Steve King, and we only have one, even thinking of good legislators is hard to do. Well, the reason that is because the county GOP and the state GOP in those states are not forcing good candidates to run. They're not molding the political landscape that will only allow good candidates to run. And when you control the county and state apparatuses, you can do that. You can make it so that anyone who is pro-immigration or anyone who supports DACA just simply doesn't get a seat at the table. So when we think about the national political conversation, I think oftentimes we fixate too much on the presidency and the metapolitics, and we don't think about the legislative process to get what we want done. The fact is, if we had a more favorable Congress, we would see immigration as a whole come to an end tomorrow. If we had a Congress that reflected the values of Americans, something like 80% of Americans want less immigration. The problem is the disconnect between the political system and the people. And we can fix that at a local level, by getting involved. And by the way, that's something that doesn't require significant investment. You don't need to go and like get a job in DC for that to happen. You can just be a guy who does your normal job and works your normal career and goes to these meetings like once a week. And if you start doing this, and if you start building a coalition of people who go and do this, we will see control swing to our favor over the national conservative political apparatus.
That sounds very promising. Can you tell me, in your view, what are the greatest steps forward that we had in the last few years? And also, what are a couple of the biggest steps back, the biggest blunders?
I think so. The biggest step forward is getting noticed and being something that is now talked about. And these ideas, because that came, and I'll get into this here with the negatives as well. You know, that's definitely a mixed bag, because we have to ask, what are we getting noticed for? But the idea of race, the political implications of race, are now being discussed by people around the dinner table. They're being discussed by normal people. And that, if that conversation is taking place, we will always have an opportunity to succeed. So I think mainstreaming the conversation about race has been certainly advantageous for us. Now, the setbacks, I think, unfortunately, and I'm relatively new to this. I have been doing this for two years at this point. I've been really involved in the political machine as a whole for about 3 years. The biggest step back was Charlottesville for a variety of reasons. And there was a lot of good to come out of Charlottesville. I would not discount Charlottesville entirely. I think the networking that was done there and the fear that it struck into the hearts of the left that, my God, you know, whites are starting to politically organize. Those are certainly positives, and those can be counted on the positive, side of the ledger. But it was also a negative in that it gave the left a lot of ammunition. It gave the media ammunition to cast us as the comic book villain, to cast us as the movie villain, to equate us with the American History X cartoonish version of Nazism that they so wanted. And this came as a result of many of the LARPing elements in the broader alt-right coming out and acting in a way that was very self-indulgent and I think very disrespectful to the movement. Again, I use that term partially facetiously, to the movement as a whole. And there are a lot of great people who were in Charlottesville. And I talked to dozens, if not hundreds of people who were good, you know, normal people with these ideas. But I think the image of white identity politics was slightly tarnished by the presence of people wearing stall helms with 1488 banners. And the self-indulgent Spurg nationalism that has unfortunately affixed itself to white identitarianism and to white nationalism and to American nationalism. I think that Spurgy element really needs to be reined in going forward. And it's happened to an extent at events. And depending on which organization you're talking about, I mean, some have very strict controls over who is allowed to join and what they're allowed to wear and what the optics are allowed to be. Groups like Identity Europa, which I am very much in favor of, but other events like the unfortunate event in Shelbyville did really nothing to further our cause. They just did more to give photo ops for the left to take pictures of, oh, look at the scary evil Nazis dressed in all black, you know, wearing stall helms. And look, I understand that activism, that I'm saying this behind a computer screen and that I'm not out there in the streets right at this moment. And so people will make the argument that, oh, at least they're doing something. But you know, what are they doing? What is the impact it's having?
First, do no harm.
Right, right. It's the Hippocratic Oath.
Yeah.
And I think they're violating that.
Yeah, I did an essay called First, Do No Harm, because that should be, that should guide us as well. Yeah, activism is great, and I've seen pictures of you with your head bloodied out in the streets, so you can definitely, you know, claim your battle scars. So yeah, I agree. First, do no harm, and if you're going to have a demonstration, ask yourself what you're demonstrating. People don't even think, you know, well, what are we demonstrating here? Are we demonstrating bad taste, bad tactics, bad organization, small numbers, and so on and
all
so forth?
All of the above.
Yeah, that is not a good thing to demonstrate. When you go out and demonstrate, you want to demonstrate strength and discipline and a focused message. Ramsey Paul made this point, and I thought it was very valid. When you have a company and some reporter comes to an employee of the company and asks them to speak for the company, they don't do that. They refer it up the chain of command to spokesmen, whereas we just have people who think they can just step forward and speak for us all. And, of course, The worst representatives are going to be the ones who end up on the evening news. There's just no messaging discipline in a lot of
right.
these sort of events.
Right. We know that the media is the enemy and they're working against our interests. Why would we give them more ammunition with which to harm and denigrate us? It does not make sense.
I think some people just have the idea that when they're being noticed, that this is somehow accomplishing something that, oh, you know, people are talking about us, and they mistake that for, you know, some kind of progress for the movement.
Yeah, all publicity is good publicity is one of the worst axioms that floats around. And basically,
yes.
It's an excuse for not planning anything, not thinking things through, just getting out there and getting noticed. Well, my response to the people who say that all publicity is good publicity is to ask them, so, was Gavin McGinnis sticking a dildo in his butt on his show good publicity. It was definitely publicity, but is that good publicity? And if you believe that all publicity is good publicity, I challenge you to do the same thing. Usually people will say, wait a second, okay, there's maybe something to this idea that not all publicity is good publicity.
No, exactly, exactly. And I think that is an element that comes from when we look at the alt-right, when we look at these politics, a lot of the people coming into these politics are coming from a sort of 4chan culture. They're coming from the culture where if you control the media and get on the news, you've won. You know, when I think back to when I was 13, 14, 15, browsing boards like 4chan, browsing these websites, the goal was with operations, it was always to get on the news. It was always to troll a reporter, put up some funny sign somewhere that would get the news out and get you covered. And that was the objective and that was the goal. And victory was, those were the conditions for victory. Now, we're getting a lot of people who come over from that sort of side of the culture, and they're carrying that mindset with them. They're carrying those objectives with them. And so they believe that just getting on the news or getting publicity is still victory. But it's not. I mean, we're fighting for something more than just a spot on your local news getting called a Nazi. We have real objectives and real goals here. And we need to think very strategically with how we interface with the media.
Right. Well, the most recent example of how counterproductive this trolling is the idiotic troll linking this shooter in Florida to the white nationalist movement, which seemed to have been spawned in 4chan.
Well, I think that guy is actually, you talk about that militia in Florida.
Yeah.
Well, I think he's just nuts. Apparently, according to the SPLC, he's been trying to do this for years. Right. You know, to get them to notice him, that, you know, that's obviously an indication that there's something wrong.
Right.
This gentleman.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry. A lot of people now have it burned into their minds that this shooter was connected with white nationalism. Most of the people who saw that initial claim have not seen the qualifications, retractions, and so forth that came fairly quickly after that. And so it has been damaging. It has been objectively damaging. And it's not good publicity. It really harms us whenever these sorts of things happen.
Right. And we have the opportunity to talk about why do these, like, when a mass shooting like this takes place, if you were thinking strategically, you would think, okay, this is a national dialogue. And why don't we talk about atomization and social disillusion and the lack of an American community that holds people together and prevents people from doing these things and gives people a sense of purpose and meaning in their lives. And, you know, maybe that has something to do with the rise in these, you know, horrific incidents, but instead, people who are unserious, who are not real strategists, who are not really ideologically motivated, who are just looking to shock. They want to put the shock and awe of saying something horrific and horrible and getting it in the media. Those people decided to unfortunately do what they did, which is they put transgression above truth, is I think how I put it previously.
Yeah, that's well put. So, James, we're heading up to an hour now. I think we should start wrapping up. So I guess the big question is, what's next for you? This is your opportunity to unfold some of your plans and also plug the current things that you are engaged in and just introduce our audience to your work, the ones who are not already familiar with it, your actual production, you know, your Twitter, your YouTube stuff, and you know, future plans.
Yeah, well, thank you. Unfortunately, I no longer have a Twitter account, so.
Oh, that's right. They banned you.
My wrong think was too wrong for Jack Dorsey. but I think that's okay because we're seeing so many people leave Twitter now. I think Twitter just put out that they lost members for the first time over a month, you know, in their latest report. So I think they're kind of falling apart anyways. But I am on YouTube. I do YouTube videos. I do about 3 to 4 videos a week. I try to do, you know, professionally produced, pro white content. And that's what I do. And I have about 195,000 followers on YouTube. So, I've been able to build a pretty significant basis there. I do a weekly podcast called Nationalist Review that comes out every Sunday. We're thinking about moving that back to Saturday, but I have a revolving panel of hosts that I call upon for that, including Spectre from TRS, including a friend of mine, Alex Witoslawski, who is a former veteran. He actually worked at Leadership Institute. He's a veteran of Conservative Inc. So I bring on people who have some real world experience in politics. And 2018 is the year that I plan to get more involved with activism and get more involved with building this political system. And I'm going to try some things. And I'm going to try to build these networks, and I may fail at first, and I may fail at building the perfect network, but I think making an effort to build these networks and to get people plugged in with their local politics and get people plugged in with enable people to put this energy towards something productive, I think that will be a step in the right direction. We have so many people right now with so much energy, but it's not directed in a positive direction. And it's not necessarily directed in a negative direction. It just isn't directed positively. And if we're going to win, we need to give people a means with which to advance our goals. And I think that, increased political activism can do that. So 2018 will be the year that I try to pivot to that, pivot to usurpation of these institutions. And I'm also going to start writing more. So, all of that, now that I'm banned on Twitter, I have more time to do productive things. So I'm going to try to write more, but, thank you for having me on.
Yeah. Twitter really is one of the worst things in the world for sort of mincing your time and attention up into little sound bites. And that can be useful. A nice, well-crafted aphorism can be useful. But for me, I prefer the longer form, I guess, the essay form, the article form. I think that you can lay out things more coherently. And if you can then use that to make videos and so forth, I think that that's a really effective way of communicating.
And one more note, I think that the Twitter format and the 140 characters, it incentivizes people to be more shocking and brutal and trolling, right? Because you don't have time to flesh out complex ideas. You don't have time to specifically enumerate all the things you're saying. It's so much easier just to say, something short and much more blunt than maybe intended. So I think it's good. It may actually be good that our guys are now off Twitter and now are being forced to do a little bit more ideologically stimulating work.
Well, that's a good way of taking advantage of necessity. And that's another factor that I think is key for our movement to grow. Whenever the system throws something down in our path, we need to find some way of turning that into a stepping stone rather than a stumbling block. And, that's how people win. That is one of the most common practices or patterns of behavior of people who are successful. They're always looking for ways of turning temporary disadvantages to their advantage. And this is one of the reasons why the left is so good at coming out on top. They don't control history. They don't control all events, like some more naive, conspiratorially minded thinking people believe, but they're really, really good at spinning everything to their advantage. Anything that comes along, they find a way of using. And I think that the more of us who think that way, the better off we're going to be. There are going to be fewer people blackpilling all the time.
Sure. So.
Well, Mike, John, do you guys have any other thoughts or things you'd like to ask James before we wrap up? I think it's pretty much a take at this point. But
well, actually, this is something that Mike and I were discussing before we started recording that we wanted to ask. Mike, do you want to ask about it, or should I?
Well, no. I mean, I kind of think if I understood everything you said earlier, James, to be true, it sounds like you pretty much came to everything, all of your views organically and spontaneously, and that you hadn't come into the College Republicans at your school with the idea of co-opting them, but rather that you just kind of were figuring out your worldview in the moment and just came to become a radical.
Yeah, any thinking, honest person in the face of evidence and the facts and the circumstances in the world and a modicum of historical knowledge I don't think you can't. I don't think you can't organically change your views and opinions. And I will also say that there are dozens. I personally know dozens of people, and I'm sure there are in hundreds of people that I don't know who are involved in this kind of campus politics milieu, who are just afraid of, who are white nationalists, who are just afraid of saying, you know, what they really believe on the topics of race or IQ even is very controversial. So I think there's hope, and just breaking the stigma around talking about these issues, breaking the stigma around these ideologies is going to unleash a torrent, unleash, it's going to open the floodgates for people who are already believing these things, but are just afraid to say it. And I think it's understandable why there are so many people who are in positions of some level of political power who believe these things but are afraid to say them, because I don't think the movement as a whole has been professional or worthwhile enough for them to justify the potential career ramifications they may suffer to publicly identify with it. And, you know, that's not to try to, you know, cast aspersions on any individuals or any organizations, but this is a relatively new thing. These are relatively new ideas to be, and these movements, this movement is facing a level of, I think, public attention that it hasn't previously. And so it's okay, and it's expected to be a little bit unprofessional, but going forward, we need to build a movement that people can be proud of. We need to build a movement that people can be proud of identifying with. And once we do that, once we let people know that it will be socially okay for them to say, yes, I am an identitarian, yes, I'm an American nationalist, more and more people will start to come over to our side, and we'll quickly learn we have more institutional power than we thought we did. I hope so anyways.
I believe that that is true, and I think that that's a very good way to end. We really do need to become a movement that's worthy of this generation of new people who are coming up, who are being switched on to identitarian ideas. The people that I've met in the last couple of years who are significantly younger than me are incredibly impressive people, highly intelligent, credentialed, educated people. Yeah, they are waiting in the shadows for a movement that they can openly identify with and put their shoulder to. So we do have to become a movement worthy of these people. Right now, the primary reason why so many people are becoming red-pilled is the system itself is breaking down. The system itself is full of conflict and contradictions, and it's leading to terrible consequences, and those are the things that are red-pilling people. We're putting information out there. People are stumbling across it, and that is very useful. That is helpful. But we have yet to create a movement that these people want to openly involve themselves with. And I think that that is the great thing that we have to do in 2018. We have to start learning the lessons of 2017. The lessons of 2017 are filled with negative examples, and we need to learn from those negative examples, those mistakes, and start doing it right. And I think that once that happens, we're going to see a breakout of nationalist ideas in the political realm that will surprise all of us. One of the most white-pilling books that I've read in the last 5 years was a book actually by a half-black guy, Malcolm Gladwell. And it's kind of a popularized book. It's called The Tipping Point. And it's just a book about how ideas and trends and products become viral. And it's really, really useful to reflect on that. One of the things that the left is always saying about us is that we have virulent ideas, and they are tipping their hands. That is their greatest fear, that our ideas will become viral and propagate geometrically. And overnight, when that process happens, you can see a complete transformation in the political realm. So, James, I think you're going to play a big part of this in the future, and we're going to all be watching your work. So thank you, and I hope this is just the first time you come on Countercurrents Radio.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me, and I appreciate the kind words and the confidence, and I hope to live up to them, and I plan on doing so, and I would definitely like to come back. I appreciate it.
Well, great. Thank you so much.
Make the movement great again.
Yeah.
Yes.
Or just make it great. Okay, well, that was good. That's a take.